This case is about an incident that occurred on July 24, 2009, inside Burleigh Food Mart in Milwaukee. Keith Scott is alleged to have intentionally attacked and assaulted Archie Talley, the plaintiff. That claim is proceeding through the trial court, although stayed at this point on its merits. We're here on the issue of whether or not that intentional assault or attack constitutes an occurrence, as that term is generally used in commercial general liability policies. I also brought to the court's attention an issue with the negligent supervision holding that the Court of Appeals made in this matter that we may also want to address. The Court of Appeals suggested that negligent supervision torts in Wisconsin can extend beyond the employer-employee relationship and into a situation where a business has a special relationship with somebody inside of its store. This is a deviation from the general rule that one does not have a duty to protect others from a third party, and also could cause some confusion with businesses in Wisconsin and insurance companies who insure them.
Talk to me about the Four Corners rule and how your position can be reconciled with that.
Yeah, so auto owners received the complaint and decided to hire defense counsel to defend its insured because, pursuant to the four corners of the complaint, there is a possibility that this loss could give rise to insurance coverage. So the insurance company, auto owners, did what insurance companies are recommended to do in Wisconsin, which is don't deny coverage from the outset, hire merits counsel, bifurcate the insurance coverage issues from the merits of the case, and then litigate whether or not there is insurance coverage. At that point, we can go beyond the four corners of the complaint and introduce extrinsic evidence, such as the depositions that were taken and that sort of thing, to determine is there actually coverage here at the summary judgment phase. So,
some of the affidavits were just portions of testimony. Are you relying on the portions that were submitted?
I believe that my office submitted the full versions to the trial court. If I'm wrong, then we submitted the important parts. There may be a local rule in Milwaukee that they don't want the entire transcript. They just want the portions that are cited. Are we talking about appendices in the trial court or?
Here.
Oh, here? Then I only would have submitted the important parts that I would want the court to consider.
Okay, so the trial court had before it, there were, as I'm looking through here, 6 depositions?
Correct.
Those 6 depositions before it when it made its findings and conclusions?
Correct, and including the plaintiff, Mr. Mustafa, as well as Mr. Scott.
So what I hear you saying is, the way you reconcile the four corners rule is, if you see negligence in there, you defend, and then you do some discovery, and then you present the issue to the trial court, and then the trial court reaches a conclusion on whether or not that case goes forward and whether you have a duty to defend.
Absolutely right. And I think that the summary judgment standards come into play once the insurance company has appropriately defended the insured, such that at the summary judgment phase there has to be evidence by affidavit or otherwise in the record to support the proposition that there is insurance coverage for the claims that are asserted in the lawsuit. You may not rest on mere allegations anymore once we're talking about ultimate coverage as opposed to the duty to defend in the four corners.
Counsel, in paragraph 20 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it indicates that it examines, number one, not only the language of the policy, but two, the four corners of the complaint, and three, also evidence in the record. That's what they set up as their preface to their analysis. Is it your position that essentially the Court of Appeals just did the four corners analysis and that's it?
It looks like the only analysis that was done was there is a negligent supervision claim pled, and therefore there is coverage for it. It does not appear that the Court of Appeals went too far. That being said, they did discuss in quite a bit of detail some of the facts and circumstances that underlied the what happened here, But there is still no evidence of this negligent supervision that the Court of Appeals and the plaintiff seem to be talking about.
Let me then be more particular in my question. The Court of Appeals said they were reviewing the Circuit Court's grant of summary judgment, declaratory judgment, and we may do as the Circuit Court did and consider not only the language and the four corners, but also the evidence.
Correct.
Is that what they did in their opinion?
I believe so. Obviously, I disagree with the conclusion they came to, but I believe that it's important to keep in mind they considered the four corners of the complaint and the allegations they were pled. At the summary judgment phase, there needs to be actual evidence of some sort of occurrence for there to be insurance coverage for a loss. And I think that was lacking there. I don't think that was recognized, but I don't disagree with Your Honor that the Court of Appeals did consider those issues.
But you disagree with their application of those three items?
Correct.
What I hear you saying is your position today is not that there can never be a negligent supervision case that would proceed for which you would have to defend. It's just that here, where the negligent supervision alleged is essentially that the store owner should instruct people in the store, whether employees or not, to not intentionally hit customers that come in. But that is not the kind of negligent supervision case that ought to proceed for which you have a duty to defend.
That's generally correct. And I think the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, who filed an amicus brief on the subject, cited cases from six different states that holding that in the situation of an intentional punch or an intentional assault, there is no occurrence, period, paragraph. That's not something that people can supervise, and the idea that we're going to tell our business owners, in order to free yourself from liability, you need to have a sit-down with your employees and tell them, don't hit people at the risk of some sort of liability, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. That being said, one can see the possibility of another action, less of an intentional punch or an assault, that could give rise to insurance coverage for negligent supervision that isn't presented here.
I had pickles on a shelf, and they weren't stacked correctly, and they fell off, and the jar burst on the floor, and someone slipped and fell because the employees weren't instructed on how to properly clean that up, for example.
For example.
Counsel, we have said before, though, that there could be coverage for negligent supervision when the underlying act was intentional, haven't we?
You have.
So, for example, you say it on page 6 of your primary, so the employer stands only for the proposition that we have no trouble including the reasonable insured and expect the policy provision to be found in fact to include the negligence of the policy, right?
Correct.
It's not the only
Well, it's a very lengthy decision with a very convoluted set of facts. That being said, I think what the Court of Appeals relied on in this case from Doyle was simply the proposition that an insured would expect coverage for allegations of negligence against it. Was a situation about somebody alleged that Ms. Doyle alleged that she was somebody else said she was kicked by her and then filed false documents with the state to tie up her assets and things like that. I think that since Doyle has been decided, this court decided the Sustashi case, however one pronounces that, and it says that no reasonable person. Let me read. would regard the alleged intentional battery perpetrated by Jeffrey against Sestache as an unexpected event or unforeseen incident. I think the fundamental difference is here we're talking about an intentional assault attack that cannot be construed by a reasonable person to be an accident such that there is an occurrence.
So isn't that a question of from what perspective we're looking at the event, right? Hang on now. So the question is, with respect to, who is the gentleman here, Scott, with respect to him, certainly that couldn't be an accident, right? It was an intentional punch, right? With respect to him. The question is, with respect to Mustafa, would Scott's punch be something unforeseen, therefore an accident or an occurrence? And here's what we said in Sestache. If the insured is also the assailant, right, so if the person doing the punching had the policy, the result is that there's no coverage for the assault. Well, that makes sense. However, where the insured is not the assailant, so that'd be Mustafa here, but is instead liable based upon vicarious liability, negligent supervision, or some other negligence theory, the assault may constitute an accident or occurrence, at least from the standpoint of the insured. So how does that not control this case?
Because there's no evidence of any accidental event other than the punch. And I think the question we're starting to grapple with is, can one see somebody assaulting and attacking somebody else as an accident from any perspective? I agree with Judge Fine in the dissent here that one can't. This is an intentional assault attack. That is not an accident. Somebody wouldn't walk by this situation and look at what transpired and say, oops, what an accident that just happened. A slip and fall is an accident.
Right. So, but I want you to focus on what Sustash and Doyle actually said, which is that an intentional act can be an occurrence from the standpoint of the insured, so long as the insured is not the one doing the intentional act, right? So I want to know, do we need to overrule Sustash or Doyle to find for you?
Well, I don't think we need to overrule Sustash. And I think the idea that in some universe there could be a situation where an intentional act by somebody else is an occurrence for the perspective of the insured is not something that I'm disagreeing with necessarily. What I'm saying is in this case, all we have here is an intentional punch, intentional assault. I think the Doyle language, and in particular the language that says if a reasonable insured would expect coverage for negligence, it can be problematic, especially in light of American Girl's fairly straightforward explanation that we decide insurance coverage not based on legal theories. The word negligence isn't used in CGL policies. If we're going to say that negligence simply means that if somebody would expect there to be coverage, that's what we're doing, is we're saying we cover claims, not facts.
Counsel, there really wasn't a contest here that Scott was not an employee, correct?
There was not a contest that he was not.
That's a double negative. Okay. So Scott was not an employee. Isn't that correct?
So Mustafa says, testified in his deposition, he was a regular customer. He came into the store.
The reason I bring it up, and there's not briefing going back and forth saying, oh, yes, he was, oh, no, he wasn't. It's pretty much the response that stepped over. But if we're going to apply Doyle here in some respect, like my colleague suggests might be the case, we would have to extend the doctrine of negligent supervision to cover people other than or in addition to employees, correct?
So
that's one question. It's either yes or no for an answer, and then you can describe it further. Because if I'm wrong, then you need to correct my premise.
So I think the occurrence discussion and the negligent supervision discussion are two different discussions.
I'm talking about negligent supervision. A claim for negligent supervision in Doyle involved negligent supervision of an employee. Okay. In this case, Scott is not deemed to be an employee by anybody, at least that I read in the briefs. Now, that doesn't mean the court couldn't extend Doyle to cover others who were not employees, that somehow the Mustafa would have had the obligation to supervise. My question to you is, would we have to extend Doyle to cover others than an employee if we were going to apply it to the circumstances here?
Yes.
Okay.
Has the time gone by for the factual determination as to whether he was an employee or not?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Has the time gone by for the factual determination to be made whether he was an employee or not?
The time has not gone by. The merits of the case are still stayed in the trial court.
And that was my understanding, reading the briefs, that is to be determined. There are two different versions as to whether he was an employee or just someone who happened to be around a lot.
Well, an employee has a meaning. There is evidence that he was in the store doing things. There is no evidence he received a W-2. There is no evidence that he was paid wages. There are no evidence of the classical meaning of that word employee in this case.
There was some testimony during one of the depositions that he received cash. Now, whether that was hearsay and would be allowed, I'm not going to argue your case. I don't. Fine. But it's to be determined.
Right. And I think to the Chief Justice's point, too, there's no evidence of an actual employment relationship.
I can see why you're running to the Chief Justice's point.
Well, that was the question that was made was specific to employees to me previously.
That's right. Right.
So, counsel, in paragraph 34, the Court of Appeals said a jury question exists on the issue of whether Scott was an employee of Mustafa, correct?
Correct.
And that is a correct statement? Yes.
Correct.
Okay. So whether we need to extend Doyle to a special employment or a special relationship is not necessarily before us.
Well,
we just have to figure out first, does a policy of this nature cover negligent supervision when the underlying act was intentional?
Yes and no. The Court of Appeals took negligent supervision a step further. I think this might be our only opportunity to address that question when it said, even if there is no employment relationship, if there is some sort of special relationship here, then there may still be negligent supervision liability. I'm not sure that was properly postured in front of the trial court or in front of the Court of Appeals, but Your Honors may only get one chance to revise that that statement if Your Honors feel that appropriate. And I do think that...
Is that question properly before us? We don't have a resolution on whether he was an employee. We don't have a resolution on what special relationship might mean. That's something the circuit court's got to do.
That's in the Court of Appeals decision,
well,
isn't it? The special relationship?
Yes.
I think
your answer to that would be probably, of course, because right now that's the law of the land.
Exactly. That is the law as it stands right now, and if Your Honors feel like that extends Miller past what it was intended to do and extends negligent supervision claims past this employment relationship, I think this might be the only opportunity to make sure that that is changed.
Right.
I'm struggling a little bit with what difference there is if someone is an employee or not, when it comes to the employer's responsibility to tell that person not to punch other people in the face.
And as applied to the facts of this case, it seems like it wouldn't make a whole lot of difference one way or the other. That being said, one of the things Miller did do when creating this tort of negligent supervision is it identified a policy.
Would there ever be an end to what an employer should tell its employees? I mean, don't murder someone, don't shoot someone, don't punch someone, don't sexually assault someone. I mean, where would that ever stop?
One doesn't know. I don't know. And I think what we're starting to get at is what the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance did a nice job on touching on in their brief, which is that these negligent supervision claims at some level have become throwaway claims to try to get money. And I think the Court of Appeals recognized this in footnote 6 of its own opinion when it said that Talley has explicitly stated that he has an interest in there being insurance coverage here because that affects access to money. And what we're doing is we're dealing with a negligent supervision claim when there's no evidence that Mustafa did anything wrong here, but solely for the purposes of trying to dress up a intentional act as a negligent one.
So, counsel, are you asking us to define what acts can qualify under a negligent supervision claim?
Not what acts could. What people have, the employers in Wisconsin have a duty to supervise.
So, to resolve this case, do we have to define what responsibilities employers have to supervise?
So, I agree with Judge Fine's dissent in the occurrence issue, where he said it doesn't matter for the purposes of the occurrence issue. I do think that if one is going to find that there is no occurrence here, one does not have to go into the negligent supervision questions. That being said, it's out there, and you know, insurers trying to consider what risks they're insuring with businesses, and business owners trying to figure out who I need to give these commands to, if I have to give them out, might read this Court of Appeals decision and have some questions, especially when this special relationship discussion comes from a case about a child sexual assault and a restatement that Your Honors haven't adopted yet.
Yeah, so
in order to be able to find negligent supervision here, we'd have to conclude that striking someone intentionally was within the scope of the duties that the employer was supposed to supervise, correct?
I'm not sure about that. I think that the scope of the employment, I think that a lot of negligent supervision claims can arise out of acts that are outside of the...
I'm not talking about other acts. I'm saying in this case where someone intentionally struck another person, we would have to conclude that the intentional striking of another person was within the scope of the duty to supervise that the employer had, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, how would that relate to Doyle then? The intentional act there was the filing of a lien on someone's real property, which had absolutely nothing to do with the employee's responsibilities at WVCY. And yet we found coverage there.
So the... It was found that a reasonable insured in Doyle would expect there to be coverage for a claim of negligently supervising its employees. I don't know that there was much of an analysis of the occurrence issue there.
Well, the analysis was a recognition that it was an intentional act on the part of the employee that had nothing to do with his responsibilities, and yet there was coverage found on a negligent supervision theory.
I think there's some troublesome language and conclusions in Doyle, I'll be honest.
All right. So that troublesomeness, I think, wouldn't that require us to overrule Doyle to agree with you?
Well, to the extent that the Court of Appeals decision says we rely on Doyle for the proposition that a reasonable insured would think there was coverage here because there was a negligent allegation against it, I think that portion should be overruled.
Now, is it your position here, the same as the non-party brief of the Alliance, that there's no occurrence under a CGL policy when the agent or invitee of the insured acts intentionally to cause bodily injury? Is that what you want the holding of this court to be?
We're not going so far. I don't disagree with the conclusions that the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance has come to. That being said, I can't rule out the possibility that there could be a situation where, Justice Bradley's jar of pickles, or sorry, Justice Ziegler's jar of pickles example comes to mind, where there could be a situation where there is an occurrence that gives rise to coverage in the context of, even in the context of a punch. Like, for example, if you have an employee who is known to punch people and you hire him under the idea that you are going to keep him away from all people in the back, and then over time your supervision gets lax and he starts to come to the front of the store and he punches someone there, one could see at least some nexus, some injury-causing event in the supervision. So I don't know that this is the forum for me to talk about the blanket statement. I don't disagree with the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance on the subject, however.
So
your blanket statement that you want the court to adopt?
My blanket statement is there has to be some... the occurrence is from the perspective of... Let me stop and restart. This was not an accident. that this intentional punch was not an accident. There is no evidence of negligent supervision here. Anything that Mustafa could have done that would have changed the analysis here. Therefore, there is no occurrence under this policy, and there's no insurance coverage for the claims being made.
But isn't that aren't you asking us to take a little step beyond what we accepted the case for? We accepted the case to determine whether there could be insurance coverage when the underlying act was intentional upon a claim of negligent supervision. You're asking us to decide the substantive issue of whether there was a tort here, right?
I don't think so.
All right. So if we... The question of whether you had said that there's nothing Mustafa could have done that would have prevented Scott from throwing the punch. Well, that's the underlying question, right? Whether there was any negligent supervision. But that question is not before us. And maybe the jury will find that there was no negligent supervision, in which case there's nothing to cover.
My red light is on. May I answer
yes,
your question?
Yes, your red light is on, but you may answer.
So in the occurrence analysis, I think that one could come to this court or come to any court in this state with, for example, the situation where the employee is told to stay away from one location and kind of meanders back there over time and say, look, the occurrence here was allowing that employee to go back over to the spot where he's not supposed to be. You didn't supervise him properly. That was the occurrence. That event led to injury. We don't have that here. All we have is this intentional punch, which no reasonable person would think was an accident.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is George Chaparis, and I represent Mr. Architelli in this case. And in our opinion, Your Honors, negligent hiring, training, and supervision, the claim was prematurely dismissed by the lower court. And the reason it was prematurely dismissed was because everybody was concentrating on an intentional tort and the tort of Keith Scott.
Let me just ask you this while you're gathering your notes
sure.
together. It can't be that all you need to do is insert the word negligence into a complaint and it transforms an intentional act into a negligent one.
You can when it's a negligent supervision and training
every
cause of action.
Intentional act, so long as the complaint says there's negligent supervision by the employer, there's a duty to defend and there's a requirement to try that to a jury.
As a matter of fact, let's look at the language of Doyle in paragraph 10, where it states, in determining an insurer's duty to defend, we apply the factual allegations present in the complaint to the terms of the disputed insurance policy. Last sentence of paragraph 10 in Doyle's opinion. An insurer has a duty to defend a suit where the complaint alleges facts, which if proven at trial will give rise to the insurer's liability under the terms of the policy. This is a separate tort. That's what everybody seems to be missing. Is that negligent hiring, firing, or excuse me, negligent training, supervision, and retention is a tort not against Mr. Scott, not against the employer or employee, but against the insured.
Counselor, how do you address Miller? And Miller specifically says negligent training must be a cause in fact of the injury that's at issue. And
or,
that goes to my question to opposing counsel is, was this striking by Scott arising from negligent training? It would have to have been within the scope of what he was obligated to train for, because under Miller it says negligent training must be a cause in fact of the injury-producing conduct. So how was this striking a cause, in fact, that arose from negligent supervision. I don't quite understand how that fits.
That was essentially going to be my follow-up question.
Yeah.
And let me just phrase it a little differently
sure.
so that you can answer both. The jury would be called upon to determine the causal connection,
right.
that is, whether the failure of the employer to exercise due care was a cause, in fact, of the wrongful act of the employee
right.
that in turn caused the plaintiff's injury. So give me that nexus.
First of all, it's either commission or omission. Negligent training of supervision is either lack of it or not enough of it, or the wrong kind of training and supervision. In this particular case, there was none. It's an omission.
Okay, so what does the employer do? What would you have the employer do?
In this particular set of facts?
Sure, or any set of facts.
Well,
where
number
you have
one,
to...
well, no, let's go to the factual situation. Mustafa, the owner of Burleigh Foods and Adams Foods and a defendant in this action, was there behind the cashier window watching all of this occurring, hearing it from beginning to end as he walked in the door, as he walked to the back of the cooler, as he came up. Mustafa was there watching. He had cameras in the store. He could see exactly what he could hear exactly what, but he did nothing.
Okay, so employers need to tell their employees to be proactive if someone comes in. So if someone comes in with a gun to rob the store, employers should tell employees to do what?
That's not the facts here. The facts here, Archie Telly walks into the door, close that MFing door right away as soon as he gets in. Keith Scott, the quasi-employee, the person with the special relationship with the employer, says, close that MFing door. And, of course, Mr. Telly, he's not going to take that just sitting down. He's not going to say, oh, yes, sir, that's what I'll do. He told him, I'm waiting for my friend who's half blind. I got to hold the door open for him. So then they get to exchanging words and expletives and everything else as they're going back and forth. And we've all seen it on TV. We've all seen it in real life. We know what happens when two people confront each other, and we got two males, two alpha males, whatever they are, confronting
each other. Well, hopefully they have a little more self-control. What about if he had a gun in his pocket and he picked it up and he shot him dead in a doornail? Would you still have a negligent supervision claim against
Mustafa? Let me finish up with this.
Counsel, before you do, perhaps we shouldn't be sitting here as a jury for your substantive case. Right? This was decided on summary judgment, yes?
Not the issue of whether he's an employee. The only issue that was decided on summary judgment was that there was an intentional tort action, therefore there's no coverage, therefore Mustafa goes on his own.
So answer me this.
Yeah.
Did anyone move to dismiss the negligent supervision claim for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted?
Nobody did.
Did anyone move to dismiss the claim on summary judgment because of lack of evidence?
Nobody did.
Okay, so as we sit here today, we don't actually know what a jury or the circuit court would say about whether there was actually a good negligent supervision claim.
That's right.
All right. So should we be talking about whether or not there was actually a good negligent supervision claim here today?
The only reason we should be talking about a negligent supervision claim today is because auto owners should be in the lawsuit and they got dismissed.
Okay.
That's the only reason we're here.
So in dismissing auto owners, was the determination that there was no negligent supervision claim or that there was no accident or occurrence?
In dismissing auto owners was only because of an intentional tort. That was the only reason. Nobody saw the negligent supervision claim. That's why I had to ask for another hearing. I said, Your Honor, we didn't even talk about our negligent supervision claim in a summary judgment.
Okay,
could
so
you answer his question?
Pardon me?
I mean, wasn't it because of an occurrence? That's what you asked.
Right.
And what was your answer to the question?
Well, there was no discussion of that in the trial court at all.
Right.
None.
So what we need to figure out today, unless I'm mistaken, is the limited question of whether this type of insurance policy can cover a negligent supervision claim, without respect to whether you've actually got one. Right? That's what we need to decide today.
Well, that's not what I appeal. That's not the question I appeal. No.
That's right.
Do you want us to decide whether you have a good negligent supervision claim?
Well, as far as a negligent supervision claim, as Circuit Court says, it is alive and well and waiting for us to try it in court right now. It's still there.
Okay, so we're not...
We have a negligent supervision claim.
Right, so we're not answering that today.
Well, we shouldn't be, no.
Well, the Court of Appeals determined because of a, quote, special relationship here, there was a negligent supervision claim.
Okay,
correct?
That's good. That's
okay,
good.
So that's an issue that was...
We're on
the
roll.
That's an issue that was appealed by opposing counsel.
Correct.
So I disagree. I think we are here to determine whether, under these facts, there is or could be a negligent supervision.
So did you ever answer the cause and fact question that was asked five questions ago?
Wait a minute. Wait.
Did you ever answer the cause and fact question?
No, he didn't.
That Chief Justice Rogenczak and I had an interest in?
Well, the cause and fact, yes. The cause and fact is the omission of supervision by Mustafa to Scott, either antecedent to the act or at the act itself. That's an omission. That is the cause and fact of the nexus between the assaulter's act and the negligent supervision.
Why do you think a negligent tortfeasor can claim indemnification from an intentional tortfeasor if there are concurrent causes of the damage, but yet an intentional tortfeasor has no claim for contribution against a negligent tortfeasor?
Because this is a tort of negligent hiring, supervision, and training. It's not against Keith Scott. Keith Scott's is just his conduct. That's all we're examining or analyzing him is his conduct. There is no tort against him. There is no claim against him. It's all about the negligence of the employer, the insured, the quasi-employer.
So what should the employer have done?
Well, number one, he should have trained him and supervised him.
Whether the person's an employee or a customer, what should this store owner have done to instruct them not to punch a customer in the face?
Well, how about have done a background check, about check for references, about checked his, did a full, thorough background check as to who this man is. This man has a criminal record, and for assault.
So, this, okay.
Let me, are you finished, Justice Ziegler?
I am, thank
okay.
you.
Let me kind of turn it a little bit around. As I understand it, we are here on a coverage question. You also have complaint that alleges that Mustafa was negligent. In other words, you could sue him personally whether or not there is coverage. So let's say this court says there is no coverage. Is your negligent supervision claim, this is the same kind of question asked by Justice Kelly, still alive and well and ready to be tried? Whether or not you win is another question.
Yes.
So this is just on the language of the policy and whether or not there is coverage for an alive negligent supervision claim by auto owners.
It's not just about the language of the policy. It's not just the four corners.
That's
we
right.
have to look at the Wisconsin state law.
I know that. I mean, do you think it's a correct characterization of the Court of Appeals opinion to say that they only looked at the four corners of the complaint?
The Court of Appeals did not look at the four corners. They looked at all the extrinsic evidence that was submitted to them.
Just like in Doyle.
Just like the trial court did, or supposedly was.
You look at the language, you look at the evidence, and you look at the complaint.
Correct.
Can I try to ask a backwards question? Give me an example of a negligent supervision or hiring claim that would be dismissed. that there would be not dismissed, strike that, that there would be no duty to defend on?
The only one I can think of right now is if an employer is alleged to have negligently trained somebody, correct, and it turns out after all the investigation discovery is done, he has done nothing wrong. He's not negligent. That's one issue.
So it would never come up in a bifurcated sense?
That I don't know. I don't know if it would come up.
Can you think of any time that this wouldn't proceed on with a full duty to defend and potential coverage?
Could you repeat that again, please?
I'm trying to think of, it's the first question I asked you. So long as you put the word negligent supervision in a complaint, there's a duty to defend and potential coverage, or is there any occasion upon which there isn't a duty to defend or coverage?
Well, first
give
of
me
all,
an example. Anything. Give me something so I can figure this out.
Well, first of all, there is a duty. Anytime you put negligent hiring, training, supervision in a complaint, it's an allegation, just like almost all complaints are allegations. And then as the time goes on, discovery goes on, we determine if there's actual truth to these allegations. If there's truth to the allegations, then yes, they stand. If there's no truth, then they don't stand. And, of course, we're not going to file a frivolous claim. If you file just a claim and say negligent hiring and training and supervision, and it's frivolous, and we know it's frivolous, we're not going to do something like that.
So your answer to Justice Ziegler means every negligent
allegation.
Every time you allege negligent supervision, it doesn't matter if Scott had had a gun in his shirt and took it out and shot the guy, or somebody else walked in who was there as a customer once in a while and beat the heck out of someone, all intentional. As long as you put in your claim that there was an obligation on the part of Mustafa in this store to supervise everything that went on, you're home free and it goes to the jury.
Well, it's that way almost with all complaints. I mean, these are allegations. These are not, we are in a notice pleading state. We're not a fact.
I understand in regard to proving the claim, but the concern here is there has to be a nexus to what you claim to the coverage that you seek.
And I gave you the nexus. The nexus.
I understand your answer.
The omission.
Yep.
It's the omission of training and supervising. That is the nexus. Now, we're not saying he should have, your employer says, oh, don't go punch him, you don't kill people, you don't do that. We're not saying that. We're just saying you be nice to the customer's always right, all that kind of stuff.
But every single bit of intentional conduct falls exactly within your complaint then, as long as you allege negligent supervision, there's always going to be coverage.
Well, let's put it this way. Negligent supervision can be a negligent act of the employee, not just intentional. In this case, it's an intentional act. However, in Doyle and other cases, I think Saatchi also states that it doesn't matter whether it's intentional or intentional, because it's not the act, it's the behavior, the conduct, which is the outcome of the supervision.
No, I understand how you are putting them together. I have a hard time conceptually understanding how you would train Mr. Scott, if he were an employee, which I'm not aware that he is, but if he were an employee, I'm not sure how you'd train him so he wouldn't go punch people. I don't know. I mean, that's the same thing as training him not to assault him. I just don't understand how that fits within the training.
That's why we don't concentrate on whether the intentional act or intentional act. It's just a bad act.
All right. So you just read it broadly. I understand what you're saying.
Counsel, isn't the answer to the Chief Justice's question that allegations of negligent supervision are tested just the same as any other allegation of negligence that could potentially create insurance coverage? That is, you could have a motion to dismiss to see if it stated a cause upon which relief can be granted, or, failing that, after discovery and introduction of extrinsic evidence, tested by a motion for summary judgment, right?
I agree.
That's how we figure out whether there is a potentially viable claim.
No. If there can be a viable claim, don't you think, without your whole case being kicked?
Right.
I mean, it's just who you get to recover against. You might have a very viable claim against Mr. Scott, for example, but that doesn't mean there's coverage of a store owner's insurance company. I mean, just because you have a viable claim that isn't dismissed That's why we set up the whole procedure of bifurcation, so that these disputes can be, after a certain period of time, resolved, and then the case proceed on to trial against the proper parties with the proper defense. Right?
But the negligent supervision claim is still in the circuit court waiting to be tried.
Right, but how would that claim be dismissed against the insurer only, other than through this kind of process?
No, it would be dismissed at trial.
Which is an answer. I mean, say that somehow the claim has to be dismissed in its entirety and for the insurance company not to have a duty to defend is missing the procedure this court has set up and long used regarding bifurcation of coverage issues, and then the case can proceed on against whomever it properly belongs.
We did bifurcate the trial. The trial was it was bifurcated.
Right.
And it was a summary judgment motion. However, the negligent supervision claim survived.
With coverage.
It survived. Well, yeah. And that's wrong, a mistake of law, why it didn't survive that coverage, because as a negligent supervision claim, it's a claim of negligence, therefore, the insurance company, if it's a claim of negligence, and there's a possible occurrence there of the negligent supervision, then as Doyle stated in...
Then any time you allege negligence, it goes through the full trial. There's no way of bifurcating it
under your argument, right?
There's no way of bifurcating coverage.
There was a bifurcation.
Counsel, let's look at, again, returning to Doyle, returning to paragraph 20 and the matrix upon which we decide this summary judgment motion. The summary judgment motion, according to the Court of Appeals in paragraph 20, is decided thusly. They say, and I'm paraphrasing, we do the same thing as does the circuit court. We look at the four corners of the complaint, we look at the evidence, and we also look at the language of the policy. So it's just not a matter of whenever you allege negligent supervision, then that's it. You've got the other things, the evidence and the words of the policy. Let's look at this policy. As I understand it, there's coverage for bodily injury, right, caused by an occurrence. And how is and bodily injury is, I think, defined. The occurrence is defined as an accident under the words of the policy, but there's no definition of an accident. So, for instance, if this policy had defined the word accident to exclude coverage when there is intentional conduct involved, it could have drafted a policy to do that, right?
It could have, but it'd be contrary to law.
Tell me why it would be contrary to law.
Well, because
I think that this is a contract, and they can draft their contract, you're right, in any way as long as it's not contrary to law. I think of oftentimes the stacking cases that we've had, the limits that we've had, how uninsured and underinsured according to the legislative action interplay one with the other. Tell me why they couldn't define accident in that
fashion. Well, they don't define accident in any insurance policy. Every case I've read, it's always occurrence, event, accident, or occurrence and event are defined as an accident, but there's no definition of accident. Why? Probably because it would take as much books as this room to fill up the policy with the description of an accident, but you know, sure they could do that and say intentional acts, but according to Doyle and Walmart and Saatchi and Schrinner, all these cases, you know, if on a negligent supervision claim, it's not whether it's an intentional act or a non-intentional act, because it's not about the underlying. The actor himself, the employee that's doing this conduct, we don't look at the conduct. We do not look at the conduct of the employee. You look at the conduct of the insured. That's what a negligent supervision injury is.
What authority? You just said we do not look in a negligence claim where you're seeking us to require coverage. A negligence claim against the employer, we do not look to the conduct, the nature of the conduct of the employee. What authority do you have for that proposition?
Just a second here. I believe it's Doyle and Miller and Saatchi.
All right. Well, one thing about your brief that intrigued me was your citation to Couch on insurance. And I looked up your citation, and your citation related to whether an occurrence is viewed from the perspective, the standpoint of the injured or the insured. So I kept reading. And can you tell the bench, if we were to require coverage here, whether we would join the majority of jurisdictions in this country to do so, or whether we would be in the minority?
Your Honor, I couldn't tell you that right now, if you'd be in the majority or the minority.
Okay. Well, if you read two sections further from the one that you cited in Couch, you come across this quotation. Some jurisdictions, and I'm going to ask this turns out not to be true. Some jurisdictions have interpreted the business entity's insurance policy to cover assaults committed by employees, partners, or agents as accidents or occurrences only if the employee, partner, or agent commits the assault while in the course of employment. But most jurisdictions have held that the policy does not cover assaults that are intentionally committed by an employee, partner, or agent. Well, that piqued my curiosity further than apparently it did yours, because I asked my law clerks to do the research to find out, to give me an example of a case where the act, where any kind of act of the employee triggered the requirement of coverage of the employer for the kind of claim you're making, and nowhere could we find a case where the intentional act, the only case that's cited for the proposition in Couch is Pennsylvania Thresherman and Farmers Mutual Insurance versus Thornton, a 1957 case, but it doesn't discuss negligent hiring or supervision. The only case I could find that comes close, was one involving, again, I think in Pennsylvania, that involved a nightclub owner where his security guards, in the course of subduing an unruly patron, suffocated him to death, but the only reason coverage was required there is because that was viewed as an act of negligence. So that is why my curiosity was drawn to your blanket assertion in response to Justice Ann Bradley that we do not look at the underlying conduct of the employee in these particular situations. When I think the accepted law of all the jurisdictions to have examined it is exactly the opposite. If you'd like to comment, you may.
My only comment would be Doyle. I mean, it says right here, Doyle's negligent supervision claim, paragraph 28 of the Doyle decision, alleges no acts causing bodily harm and harm which were intended by WVCY as a protected person under policy.
I'm sorry. Were you done? I didn't hear you if you were.
Excuse me?
Go ahead. Say that again, please.
Instead, Doyle's supervision claim focuses on WVCY's negligence, who is the employer and supervises his employees, and then it says, hyphen, whether or not the employees committed the underlying wrong intentionally. So I'm going by Wisconsin law.
Can I bring you back to the policy, something that I don't think we've talked much about today, the exclusions in the policy. So you're taking the position that Mr. Scott was an employee of Mustafa. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. That makes him an insured under the policy, does it not?
It does.
We accept that. Okay. When I go to the exclusions, section B1 of the policy, it says, this insurance does not apply to bodily injury expected or intended from the standpoint of the insured. So from Mr. Scott's perspective, do you think that it's reasonable to conclude that he would expect that he'd injure somebody if he punches them in the face?
That he'd injure somebody if he punched the face? Yeah.
Yeah. One more, and then I'll let you comment. Under personal injury exclusion, there's an exclusion for injury arising out of the willful violation of a penal statute committed by the insured. So would you also agree that Mr. Scott violated the law by committing a battery against your client?
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't that exclude coverage?
No.
Why?
No. Because the conduct of the assaulter is not what we look at in a negligent hiring and supervision claim. I mean, that's the law of negligent hiring, training, and retention. It's not. It's the conduct of the insured, and whether the act of the employee, whether it's intentional or not, whether his conduct was the result of improper training, hiring, and supervision and retention. That's what it is.
That may be the claim. I think what Justice Bradley is asking you about is a contract question, not a question about whether you can make the claim that you're making against Mr. Mustafa or Mr. Scott. It's an interpretation of the contract that says if he is an insured, and as an employee he would be an insured. Okay, so you want to look at it from the conduct of the insured. He is an insured. How can you just step over that by saying, oh, well, it was somebody else. Mr. Mustafa was supposed to train him. So we don't look at this insured's conduct, even though he's the guy that did the socking. We look at the guy's conduct that we think should have trained the insured.
My red light's going to go on in just a second.
Red light's not on, just the yellow light. You got 5 minutes with it when that's on.
Again, the language of the policy, yes, excludes any kind of coverage for Keith Scott, the assaulter. Yes,
mm-hmm.
It does.
Right.
However, the language of the policy does not exclude coverage for negligence for the insured.
But the insured is also the insulter here. How do you get around that?
No, the insured is not the assaulter in our case.
Why not?
Because his act, he didn't assault anybody. All he did was allow it to happen and did not properly supervise.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, this is a lively discussion, so you are up to sort some things out for us. Thank you.
Before you start, let me pick up where counsel just left off, because what I think his argument is and what I've been struggling with this whole time is he's saying, look, we're not asking that you find Scott to be the insured because he is. And insurance coverage under this policy is excluded for him under the terms of the policy. But our allegation arises out of the employer, who is also an insured. And that insurance, as to that insured, the employer, is because of their negligent behavior, regardless of the intentional conduct of Mr. Scott. So help us with that, because this is a two-tiered approach. It would be one thing if they were just suing Scott, and Scott's an insured, and we're seeking coverage for Scott. Because of that language, that's a no-brainer, I think. But with respect to the negligent supervision of the employer, to what extent is it relevant that the employee or customer, Scott here, would on his own be completely and totally excluded from coverage?
There's a lot there. I think first things first, the exclusion that we talked to about bodily injury intended or expected from the standpoint of an insured, and if we're taking the position that Mr. Scott isn't insured, it seems like that would apply square on. Now, meeting with the insured in this case early on, with Mr. Mustafa, I should say, his position has been clear that not my employee, and so Auto Owners has not taken the position that Mr. Scott isn't insured under our policy just because Mr. Mustafa is telling us that he isn't. We trust our insured. He's our policyholder who pays his premiums. That being said, I don't disagree with Your Honor that intentional acts exclusion causes some problems as soon as Mr. Scott becomes an insured under this policy.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up to that question and a follow-up to mine, because can we, as Mr. Chaparros, I think, is suggesting, can we segregate out claims and look at insurance separately for Mr. Mustafa and separately for his employee, if we assume that Mr. Scott was an employee, or do we look at the insurance policy as a whole? Because when I read the exclusion section, it's section B1, and it says this insurance does not apply to, and then goes into the exceptions that I mentioned. So to me, that suggests that this insurance, it means coverage for anybody who's insured.
Absolutely. And I think that is a question of how the policy is drafted. And as Your Honors, I'm sure, have seen, some intentional acts exclusion language differs here and there. This one is pretty clear that this insurance doesn't apply to any intentional acts or bodily injury arising out of intentional acts committed by the insured. And if the insured includes Scott, it seems like we have a fundamental problem here.
Do we need to deal with language in Doyle then?
I don't think so. I think this policy does what it needs to do in that situation, assuming that Mr. Scott isn't insured under our policy, which is not the position that Auto Owners has taken, but assuming arguendo that there is a negligent supervision claim against him, he's an employee, that would make him an insured under our policy, which would trigger the cascade that Your Honors have been talking about.
Counsel, in Doyle, we were faced with that very argument by the insurance company that because the employee is also an insured, then the intentional acts exclusion prevents coverage. But we rejected that in paragraph 27. In fact, we said we disagree with the form of the analysis offered by the Court of Appeals. It is significant in this case that the coverage disputed by the parties is not St. Paul's obligation to defend WVCY's employees individually for their intentional acts against oil. Rather, the coverage we are addressing is WVCY's individual coverage as a protected person under the policy. So we would have to reject that language to agree with you, wouldn't we?
I disagree. I don't know what the intentional acts language said in Doyle, but some of those intentional acts exclusions will say this insurance, or we do not cover intentional acts committed by an insured. And in that sort of situation, this language in Doyle would apply equally to that sort of situation, but also the language in this policy, which says this insurance doesn't apply to bodily injury caused by an intentional act by an insured.
By the insured. And in this case, Scott is not the insured we're talking about. We're talking about the employer.
You know, counsel, yes. You were about to say yes.
No, and I apologize. The insured, if Scott is an employee, then he's an insured.
You know, counsel, and I got my question just before your red light went on, so I'm going to say it counts. And I do not understand how you can say no to Justice Ziegler and to Justice Kelly when they each ask you if we have language to deal with in Doyle. When you heard my colloquy with your opposing counsel, and I read, well, Couch doesn't support his position, and apparently no other jurisdiction does, the language in Doyle could not be more broad. I fail, and I did not understand your response. I'm insisting on an answer. If you want to just say I stand by my answer, that's fine. But I did not understand your response to Justice Kelly when he asked you point blank, how is it we do not have to either clarify or in some other way deal with that broad language in Doyle?
And I think in my first argument, I did indicate that part of this needs to be overruled. Are we talking about my answer just now?
Yes.
Well, because I think we were talking about paragraph 27, in which we're talking about an intentional acts exclusion. And I think the intentional acts exclusion discussion to me is different from what I agree is a very broad occurrence.
So that was different from, and then I got to wind up because the red light is on. That was different from what I was asking your opposing counsel about in regard to, regardless of the intentionality or negligence of the conduct of the employee. Thank you. Yes?
That's correct. And the occurrence issue and the intentional acts exclusion issue get confusing.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Thank
all right.
You.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for really wild and interesting arguments. Usually insurance cases are not so spirited. You both did a great job. And the court obviously is very interested in your case and had a lot of questions. So thank you very much. We're going to take a brief break so that the next attorneys can get themselves lined up and ready to go. We are adjourned.